As the silent seconds dance in their eternity about me and set aflame again the fire to inspire my nimble fingers to procure the pen and awaken it in a resurrection, transforming the ink to the blood of the writer. As once again he bleeds his acquired wisdom like a light into the world.
Good morning, Carborough and the Big Chill, Chapel Hill that is. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, coming at you from the studios of WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm here in the studio with John Paul McLellan, my co-host.
Hello, and a good, happy, foggy morning to everybody.
Hope you can see through the fog. And we have the honor of having Jerry Davis with us, who is the artistic director of Burning Coal Theatre.
Hello.
So we're basically going to ramble on today, digging into aspects of his life, as well as how he came about with launching that, I believe, Jerry and his wife, and find out the history of Burning Coal Theatre, as well as quite a few degrees of his own life, or their life, their lives together. And at this point, I'm just going to turn it over to Jerry and launch this project.
First of all, thank you, both of you, Claudio and John Paul, for having me on this this program. I listened last week when you had Peggy Tapworm from the Temple Theater on. And
what was a character, yes.
She's quite a firecracker, yeah, and a wonderful new person to have in the theater community
here. Area,
yeah,
yes,
yeah, very much so. But thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We're very excited over at in Raleigh at Burning Coal because this last weekend we opened the permanent home for the theater, which is the Murphy School Auditorium. It's a project that we've been working on as a group for about 7 years now, and that I've been working on in my mind for many more than that.
And you mean establishing a permanent base?
That's right. Finding a place. We have been an itinerant or a vagabond or a homeless theater for the first 10 and a half years of our existence.
Which was undoubtedly part of your charm in the whole, because there's been street-level talk about Burning Coal ever since you began it.
Well, I appreciate that compliment. We've had a great deal of success in Raleigh, and I think this is the next step for us, finding a permanent building, and in this case, particularly one that has such resonance from a historical standpoint. The Murphy School Auditorium, as you may know, Claudio, was the first integrated school in Raleigh back in 1960, and in fact, the auditorium where we will be performing from now on was the room in which the Raleigh City School Board met in the summer of 1960 and voted to begin the desegregation of Raleigh schools. And so the vote to desegregate Raleigh schools took place in the auditorium, in the very room that we'll be performing in. And I think that
that's extraordinary.
It's a fairly reasonable comment to say that makes it the most important room in Raleigh. I'm not sure what room would take precedent.
Yeah.
Right. And so but it's been sitting empty since 1977. So for 30 years and some, and it's in a wonderful area of the town in the north end of downtown Raleigh. Jokingly been saying that it's halfway between the governor's mansion and the Krispy Kreme,
which puts it down to earth level for everyone.
It is something that we can all relate to.
Yes.
And everybody knows where it is one way or the other. Although,
and actually, now that you've described it, I know exactly where it is.
I have to confess that more people respond to the Krispy Kreme side than to the governor's mansion.
Go there for that cup of java and a donut.
Yeah. Right, that's right. I anticipate gaining a considerable amount of weight once we move into the space, but it's a terrific building. It's an old building. It was built in 1913. It actually was built originally in 1908, and it burned down almost immediately. It was rebuilt, and I'm going to find a piece of wood to touch as I say this, but it was rebuilt as a fireproof school, the first fireproof school building in Raleigh, and so far so good.
Well, I guess if you build it out of stone, you make it pretty vibrant.
That's right, and there was nothing in that building that could burn, and so it has lasted a long time, and we went in the last year, about 30 of our company actors, and directors and designers went in with hard hats and masks and mallets and knocked off about an inch of what is apparently called horsehair plaster, which is plaster mixed with horsehair.
Interesting, for strength.
Right, and it was very interesting because you'd pound and pound and pound and nothing would happen, and then suddenly about a 5x7 chunk of the stuff would come falling down on your head. And so it was an interesting and dangerous experience, but what was under it was so beautiful. The original brickwork that was put there in 1908, some of it still charred by the flames of that original fire. And so there's such a texture, such a resonance to the architecture of the space and the texture in the space.
I can imagine.
And we're going to put on top of that the kind of work we do, which tends to be a little more contemporary, a little newer, a little more cutting edge. And I think the juxtaposition of those two ideas in the space are really what's going to make it fly.
And what may I ask, was it that drew your focus to that place, that realm as a home base?
Well, it was when my wife Simi Kastner and I moved to Raleigh from New York in 1996, we immediately began to look around. I remember, you know, we were both working day jobs at the time, and so on the weekends we would drive around the city looking for old buildings that appeared to be neglected or abandoned or in disarray. And also we began to ask people almost right off the bat. And I remember a theater couple that you probably know from your experiences in Raleigh, Bunny and Jack Safran.
I do know them.
I believe were the first. They run a company called Actors Comedy Lab. And yes, I believe they were the first people to say, what about the Murphy School Auditorium? And it sounded interesting.
I do remember seeing it boarded up.
Yes.
The windows.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. People had thrown, you know, stones through it and that sort of thing. There were pigeons in there and termites and squirrels living in the walls and all kinds of things. But as soon as we saw it, we realized from an architectural standpoint and from a geography standpoint, there's that old adage of location, location, location. We're right in the middle of everything downtown in the Murphy School, including, and this was not something that we knew about when we began the project 7 years ago, but there is now a development project underway called the Blunt Street Revitalization Project. That's being conducted by a company called LNR Properties, and they're building about 500 new housing units within three blocks of the Murphy School in any direction. And you can extrapolate about 1,000 new urbanite, you know, urban dwellers that'll be literally within a stone's throw of our building and be able to walk out their back door and across the street and they're at their theater.
Wonderful. That should up the property value eventually as well.
I think it'll help.
It's always a good thing.
And it'll solidify our base audience.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I want to say about that is that we're really adamant about working to make Burning Coal Theater Company a theater for the entire triangle, and we don't want people to start thinking of it as the Raleigh or downtown Raleigh or the Oakwood
off.
Theater, right?
But I was going to say you do have the old historical Oakwood, literally I want to call it village there,
right.
That whole historical aspect, which I tried to move to but could never get a place because they were always all either rented or sold.
Highly sought after real estate. And
lots of fun hippies living there.
Or ex-hippies in a few cases. And so many wonderful. Claudia, we began about a year and a half ago, we began this project in the Oakwood Cemetery.
Ah, yeah.
Which doesn't...
Beautiful cemetery.
It is. It doesn't seem like the kind of place that a theater folk would want to hang out, but what an amazing stage for storytelling. And so what we do there is a couple of times a year we go in with actors in costume, and those... And those actors will literally come out of the woods and tell the story of someone who's buried in the Oakwood Cemetery, in some cases from, you know, 150 years before, and then go back into the woods, change costume, run around, and come out and do another one. And the audience, in the meantime, is walking, you know, doing a sort of a walking tour of the place. And so they get to see the geography of the Oakwood Cemetery, which which is extraordinary, which is profoundly moving in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then on top of that, they get to hear these amazing and funny and sad stories that we have, no pun intended, unearthed.
That's right.
and the for instance, I'm just going to give you a couple of for instances.
All
the
right.
The man who was the model for Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind.
Sure.
His name was Red Upshaw.
Gable's character.
That's right. And he was the first husband of Margaret Mitchell. He's mm-hmm. buried in the Oakwood Cemetery.
Oh, I did not know that. Wow.
It's true. He was killed in New Mexico in a card game, in a poker game, shot because he accused someone of cheating. And, of course, they didn't fly people back then to bury them. So he must have been driven by, a train or something like that and brought back into the area and buried. And his whole family's at one end of the cemetery, and he's at the other end.
Oh,
so they wanted to bury him as far away from them as possible because he was such a black sheep in the family. And so we've made Red Upshaw a recurring character. And each time we do one of these walking tours, Red shows up and sort of is the skunk at the garden party, if you will, and quite delightfully so. Jimmy Valvano is buried at the Oakwood Cemetery.
I didn't know that, okay.
Yes, he is, and Coach Valvano is near and dear to my heart, not because
yeah.
I was a State fan, because I didn't live here and I didn't know much about it, but the first basketball game I ever remember as a young person watching was the final in 1983, and I latched on to the underdog and was delighted at the result, so that's important. And then there are stories there was a set of Siamese twins that lived in the Oakwood Cemetery that are buried at the Oakwood Cemetery. They lived together their entire lives. They were joined together. They were not able to separate them, and each was married, and one of them had 10 children and the other one had 11 children. And so one's mind reels thinking of what
yes,
it must have been like
absolutely.
In that house, so fascinating stuff. We do that.
How long did they live? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I have the exact details, but into their 40s,
wow,
I think.
That's pretty amazing.
So quite a while, but they must have been quite active.
They must have.
And so anyway, we do that twice a year. We're going to the dates are not yet set, but in late May we'll do another episode of the Oakwood Cemetery walking tour, which is very theatrical. And I think helps to tie our company to the community. It makes the community feel like that we are interested in them, which we are, and it also educates us as artists about the people around us. And I'm not sure there's a better thing that we're, or a more significant thing that we're doing as a company right now than that initiative.
I was just thinking about the cemetery itself. I dated a girl named Bonnie who was still a friend, but years ago, and she wanted to go and have a picnic in that area. That's how I got to know it.
It sounds like
the
beginning
of a cemetery.
It sounds like the beginning of a joke.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I won't take that any further.
Okay, good.
Bonnie might be listening.
Right. My Bonnie lies over there.
There we go.
Okay. Burning Cold's doing a lot of things now that I'm very excited about. We have an education program that sends a trained professional theater artist into schools, middle schools, high schools, occasionally elementary schools as well, to train the young students in vocal techniques, speech and also in movement. There are some fairly radical new movement ideas in the theater world right now. Viewpoints, for instance, which is the main proponent of which is a woman named Ann Bogart. We're training the kids in Viewpoints, and that's the kind of training that they typically don't receive until at college, if then.
Yeah, I can see that.
And so it's helping to give the young people in the area a little bit of a leg up, I think, and introducing them to some new ideas.
Let's go a little more full circle here on this.
Okay.
You launched Burning Coal Theater with your wife.
That's right.
Let's bring her into the picture and give me the background as to how the two of you met and then how Burning Coal came about in the first place.
Well, Simi Kastner is my wife, and there's a really interesting, what I think is an interesting story about how we met. On New Year's Day, 1991, because of a bag of trash. This was
where?
It was in New York City. I was living on the Upper West Side, and she was living on the Lower East Side.
And you're originally from Nashville yourself.
I was born in Nashville, and I grew up in a little town called Murfreesboro, Tennessee, right. Which is known for... give me a moment.
25 people that know each other.
That's right. No, it's a nice town. It's a lovely little southern town. But anyway, so Simi and I were living on the extreme ends of the island, and our paths were not likely to cross, but for a bag of garbage. And the story is that the previous night, I'm hoping that the wrong people don't hear this story because it involves something a little... dicey, but I'll go ahead and say it.
And you think me dating in a graveyard is weird.
Right. Simi had been to a New Year's Eve party the night before at her with her cousin, Anne. And with Simi at the time was her best friend from Chapel Hill, who had come up to New York for the holidays, and she had brought with her her future husband. He was dating her at the time. And the future husband and Anne, this young actress who was Simi's cousin, immediately and passionately despised each other for reasons that probably have to do with genetics, you know. But they just immediately hit it off in the wrong direction and began to fight. And so Anne was having a New Year's Day brunch the next day, and she knew that that she didn't want to invite Simi, because if she did, she'd have to invite her friend from Chapel Hill, and she'd have to bring her boyfriend, her fiance, along. And so Anne didn't invite her. But she did invite me, because I knew Anne from a theater company that we had been working with together. So I'm walking through the snow on New Year's Day, trudging down from 74th Street down to East 25th Street, and wondering all along the way, why am I going to this? I won't know anybody there. It's going to be boring. And that morning, Anne walks out onto her balcony to stow a bag of trash, you know, mm-hmm. On the balcony
to clear the little apartment. Good, okay.
Right. And as she's putting the trash in the trash can, she looks down on the street and sees Simi depositing her friend from Chapel Hill and her boyfriend into a taxi cab with their luggage.
Mm-hmm.
They're gone. They're out. They're leaving for the airport. And so Anne runs back inside, calls Simi, who lives across the street from her,
mm-hmm.
and says, "Say, I'm having a brunch in about 15 minutes. Would you like to come over?" And Simi said, "Sure, I'll come." And Simi and I met at that party. And the same way that Anne and the boyfriend had hated each other, we were in the opposite camp. We were immediately drawn to each other and compelled by each other's interests and history and that sort of thing, and so we started talking, and not long after that we decided to get married, and one of the first questions out of my mouth was, "Do you want to help me start a theater company? It's something I've always wanted to do." And it turned out Simi had a background in theater. She had wanted to be a scene designer when she was a young girl growing up, and the 70s don't seem like that long ago, Claudio, but she was...
No, they don't.
She was turned away at every opportunity. Every teacher that she had told her, you're a girl, you can't do this. This is a man's world. One teacher at her high school wouldn't give her the tools to draft which she needed in order to apply to one of the colleges that she was going to. He refused to let her have the tools to do this drafting project. And, of course, that sort of thing today could get a person fired, if not sued. But back in the 70s, the early 70s, it was a mountain, you know, to climb. And Simi tried to climb it a little while and spent two or three semesters at Northwestern in the scene design program and met the same kind of resistance there. As she had in high school.
Now, what was she doing to make a living at that particular time?
Well, she was a kid. She was in college, so she was still... Her father was a physicist, and her mother was an administrator at a college. She was like a secretary to the dean of something or another.
I see.
So anyway, so Simi tried it for two or three semesters and found the same kind of resistance at Northwestern, which was one of the great theater programs in America at that time. Mm-hmm. And so she quit. She wanted, she loved painting, and so she got a degree from American University in Washington, D.C. in computer science and in painting. She got two degrees, actually. And, of course, today those two degrees work quite well together, given the web design and that sort of thing. But at the time, they seemed like sort of quixotic.
It was still emerging.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so she slipped less and less, she slipped away from the artistic side of her and into the business side, and she became quite good at what she was doing.
How long was it your stay in New York City together, and then what drew you to North Carolina?
Well, both of us lived there. We both, interestingly enough, moved there about the same time, and we lived there for about 12 years. But we didn't know each other until that January morning in 1991. And then we moved to Raleigh.
And how many years was that into the 12 years?
That was about 7 or 8 years in. So we moved to Raleigh in 96, I guess it was, early in 96. And we had looked around quite a bit for a place to start a theater company. And I knew I wanted it to be in the South. Mm-hmm. I felt like another theater in the Northeast, frankly, was Colston, Newcastle. You know, there's just they have enough.
They have plenty.
And we wanted Simi and I wanted to go somewhere where we could make an impact and where we could offer something to the community that it didn't necessarily already have.
And what was the original premise? What was the original idea in your mind that would make Burning Coal Theatres maybe perhaps somewhat different than other existing theatres? What was your spark there, so to speak?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is simply put that our ultimate goal, which we've not entirely achieved yet, is full professional status. We want to pay everyone a living wage who works with our company, and Raleigh doesn't have a repertory company of professional artists that work together regularly.
That's true, yeah.
The Chapel Hill does in Playmakers over here, which is a wonderful company and with national recognition.
Mm-hmm, yes.
One of the great theaters in the United States, certainly one of the great ones in the southeastern United States. And I'm very excited, just as a side note, about Joseph Hodge, who's taken over recently as the artistic director. I think he's going to bring a whole lot of new energy and connections. And
have they got anything coming up that you're familiar with?
They're doing a double bill right now, I believe, of Top Dog Underdog, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play of a couple of years ago, and Doubt, Patrick Shanley.
Doubt has actually got quite a reputation at this point.
And go see them both. Everything I've seen at Playmakers has been exceptionally well done.
Yeah,
and
I
that's
think so too.
That's sort of the goal that that we're moving toward, I guess. The second point to that two-point idea is that we want to do work that's a little more challenging, both in from the standpoint of its substance, you know, what it's about, but also from the standpoint of the forms that it takes.
Are you speaking of that more in the traditional medium or also in the local and original mediums?
Both, I think.
Because I know you're doing the, what's the play you're doing now?
Inherit the Wind.
For some reason, I keep thinking 12 Angry Men.
Right.
Inherit the Wind.
Right.
And that, of course, is definitely traditional.
It's very traditional.
But I'm really more familiar with Burning Coal on the original spectrum.
Uh-huh. Well, we're interested in developing new voices for the theater. And I think that's, maybe that's the third component to our mission that perhaps separates us a little bit, or makes us makes us valuable to the community, makes us a component that isn't there already. And we've developed several new writers over the years. It's not easy to do. It's a difficult proposition. The great young writers want their work done in New York or at one of the major regional theaters, the Guthrie or
some place that can pay off.
Right. And so you have to develop them at a very early stage in their life. And this year we've begun a program called Kids Write, which we're going to start out in Wake County this year, and it's a playwriting, essentially a competition. We're asking kids from age 6 to 18 to submit plays, and there are several different formats they can take, short 10-minute plays or one act.
I was just thinking short works. Yeah.
Right, or full lengths. We'll take those too, but we're going to accept submissions from Wake County school students. And we're going to produce the scripts that we select for production in the summer, using professional actors and directors. And so the kids will be able to spend a week in rehearsal with professional artists and see that process of developing a play. And they'll be, fully mounted, maybe too strong of a phrase, but there will be, sets and lights and costumes and that sort of thing, and the actors will be off book, so it won't just be a reading
good.
Of the play.
Okay. And that'll do great things for the just spiritually. It will be a wonderful thing for the kids to have that.
Well, I think so. I think that's a good point.
To be immersed into the reality.
Okay.
I just want to let you folks know this is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, and I'm going to let John Paul give the other lingo there.
Yes, this is my very special time. I get to say to you, this is WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.
And that's enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also we have a PSA. Legendary international blues musician Philip Walker will be interviewed live on your community radio station this coming Thursday, February 7th, just after 7 p.m. on Carrboro Live. His new album, Going Home, will be released shortly on the Delta Groove label. Be sure to listen to Dr. Tofu and KC Carroll here on your community radio station Thursday at 7 p.m., and that is WCOM 103.5. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, in the studio today. Other than my co-host John Paul, we have Jerry Davis, artistic director of Burning Coal Theater, and we're basically getting the scoop on what Burning Coal is all about and also what it aspires to be. And on that note, I'm going back to Jerry Davis, unless John Paul has something to say before I bounce in that direction.
Back off your microphone a little bit.
Oh, that. Details. Well, the reason I'm on it is because I'm not hearing myself in the headset. So there we go. Arguing in public. How's that? Back to Jerry Davis.
So, Claudio, the thing that I'm most excited about right now is this new building that we're in, the Murphy School Auditorium, which I was talking with you about a little bit before. It's it's a different space, and I don't want to say
what makes it different, Baird. Because I was going to ask, first of all, how many does it seat?
Well, it can seat up to 175, and that alone is unique in the area. There are several smaller venues that have seats ranging from 40 seats to 90-95 seats, and then from there you more or less jump up to the much larger venues like the Fletcher, Mimondi, the Stewart Theater over at NC State. But there aren't many spaces that are available for artists in the community to use that are in between.
I can imagine.
And we are going to make our space available to as many of those emerging arts groups and individuals as possible. Somebody asked me the other day if we were going to give up our rehearsal space now that we've got the performance space. And I said, heck no. We don't want this wonderful facility, the Murphy School Auditorium, to become a rehearsal hall. We want it to be a performance venue.
Gotcha.
And so we're going to try to find and reach out to as many young and emergent artists as possible and get them in there. And it's just a terrific space. Right now it's configured as a three-quarter thrust for an Inherit the Wind, but it is flexible, so it can be Theater in the Round.
Oh, wonderful.
It can be proscenium, right? And here's the what I think makes it a very interesting space. It has a wonderful little balcony on three sides that provides a very steep and interesting angle onto the stage, and so people can watch the play in a way that you don't typically get to watch a play. It feels like you're sort of on top of the actors, looking down at them. And so it's a beautiful space, very well designed by our architect, Lewis Cherry, who did the new library at Cameron Village.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. And the contractor is a man named Greg Paul, who's just been amazing. He's almost literally given his life over to this project for the last 7 months is about how long it took to actually do the build out. But he's been working on it many more years than that, working with us, helping us to raise funds. And
you must have connected with his passion.
Well, we connected with his daughter very early on. It's in our very first season, 11 years ago, we had an audition for a Shakespeare play, and his daughter auditioned. She didn't actually get cast, but I liked her very much. I liked the enthusiasm that she brought, and so I asked her if she'd consider working backstage in the role of assistant to the stage manager, and she did. And Greg, so he came and saw the work, and he said to himself and to other people, this is something that's going to elevate the art form in our area. This company is something a step beyond what we're used to, and I need to hitch my horses to that wagon.
Good.
That's the kind of compliment that is tantamount to putting your money where your mouth is.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's what Greg has done for us. The third member of our little triumvirate, if you will, is a man named Curtis Casefang, who walked up to me one day on the steps of the Murphy School Auditorium about 3 years ago and handed me his business card and said, I'd like to volunteer my services for this project. And I looked at the card, and my heart sort of fell, you know, because it said the consultant on the card. And I thought, okay. But for some reason, I kept that card on my desk. Thank God I did. Curtis Casefang knows more about theater than I will ever know, than any 10 men will ever know. He's absolutely brilliant. He knows not just about the art form, which he's actually quite knowledgeable about, but about the nuts and bolts, the specific ways in which good theaters are so, mm-hmm. and the ways in which not so good theaters fail, and he has been able to guide us every step of the way, saying, do you really want to put that there? Wouldn't it be better if we put that over here? And he's right every time, which
fantastic.
Is alarming. And thank goodness we have him and Greg and Louis Cherry, and together they have managed to take the ideas that have been festering in my mind for the last, probably 30 years, to be honest with you, and make them into a three-dimensional reality.
Fantastic. Well, so if you folks are listening, this is certainly a gesture of gratitude from Jerry Davis to you for all the good work you've put in. On that note, I would like to take a moment to turn to John Paul, whom I have deprived of communicating the unmedia for a couple of shows now.
What?
Yeah, you sleepy. Wake up.
Hello.
Rip Van Winkle over there.
Is it morning yet? Oh, okay.
Well, with all that coughing, you didn't notice.
The fog has cleared.
Right.
Yeah, I've had a little
today being
tickle in my throat.
The fact that today is Super Stooge Day, or was that Tuesday, I thought you might have some input on what's going on politically.
Well, the latest thing that's happening that you never hear about and will never hear about on the mainstream media is the information about Philip Zelikow, who very few people in the entire universe...
Sounds like a cartoonist, who is he?
Yes.
Gesundheit.
You're not going to... Yes.
Gesundheit.
Excuse me, I've had this little cold and little post-nasal drip, so I have a little trouble.
He's a drip altogether this morning.
Well, he is... Philip Zelikow is the guy who was appointed to be the chief of staff of the 9/11 commission. And the new information that's come out about him is that during the whole period of the so-called investigation,
yes,
done by the Cain Commission,
edited by the Bush administration,
well, it turns out that Zelikow was regularly talking with Turd Blossom. Turd Blossom being
that one, yeah.
Turd Blossom being Karl Rove.
Oh yes, of course. Right.
And this was during the time that he was administering the staff. So now you see that Turd Blossom had input into Zelikow during the whole period of time that the commission was supposedly doing their, quote, final report on, what really happened on 9/11.
I heard that report on PBS, yeah.
Yeah. So, and of course, Zelikow had promised when appointed that he would not communicate with people in the White House. Hmm. Because obviously that would be a conflict of interest, since they
one
were going
would
to
think
be,
so. Yeah,
they were going to be subjects, at least, of information gathering to make the report. Well, and then so when he's confronted with this fact that he had been speaking with Karl Rove when he wasn't supposed to be. He said, well, we didn't talk about anything political, so it's okay.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, we didn't, you know, nothing happened that was untoward. But there you have it. This guy is and, you know, when you couple that with the other information about his background, one, that he was very close to Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, yeah.
That they published a book together.
Exactly.
He used to work for her.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the transition team when Bush came into office the first time he stole the election.
Just the mafia recirculating itself.
Yeah. And you have, you know, obvious, intense conflicts of interest there, which say that this guy should never have even gotten close to the commission staff.
So you can greatly consider 9/11, or at least the report, a work of fiction to a great extent.
Well, it's total fiction. It's the stupidest conspiracy theory that anyone could think of, that some guys from a cave in Afghanistan had anything to do with this event is just utter hogwash.
Yeah, I'm more inclined to believe that at this point than anything else.
All the information if people have the time, some people don't have time, I understand that, but if they have the ability to look at this information, they will see very quickly that there's plenty of information that indicates that what the 9/11 Commission reported is just complete balderdash.
You know, in communicating with Jerry a little earlier today, he brought up an interesting aspect, talking about American soldiers getting killed, and he says it's interesting how we receive reports of the soldiers dying, but we rarely are ever told what they were killed with or what weapon was used, because in so many cases it may well be that Americans are being killed with American weapons formerly sold over there.
In almost all cases, that's the case. This garbage about Iran having... bringing in lots of weapons. That's baloney. Iran has no interest in doing that.
The Shah of Iran was supported financially and with weapons by the American government years ago.
Exactly. So, you know, the whole thing is, look, most of the terrorism that goes around the world is fomented by the United States secret government in cooperation with various intelligence services from other countries around the world, including the Mossad, French mm-hmm. intelligence, English intelligence. I mean, all this stuff that we see in the papers that's attributed to Al-Qaeda, most of that stuff is not done by Al-Qaeda. It's done by our people and blamed on Al-Qaeda.
We're told what they want us to hear to a great extent.
And by the way, it was the U.S. intelligence services that invented Al-Qaeda, that funded the development of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and that trained Osama bin Laden and others in U.S. military facilities. Osama bin Laden took training in the United States and at U.S. Facilities. So did several of the people who are claimed to have been the hijackers in 9/11, which, by the way, none of them were, because there were no names of any of the hijackers on the flight manifests for any of those four planes that were supposedly hijacked. If you look at the published list that is the manifest, and you know what a flight manifest is, what they make when you're entering the airplane. When you go onto that skyway, you hand them your little boarding pass.
Mm-hmm.
That identifies you as a passenger. They enter that into their computer, and your name is entered on what's called the flight manifest. If you didn't go through that skyway checkpoint, you didn't get on that plane, all right, as a passenger. So if your name's not on that flight manifest, you're not on that plane. None of the hijackers' names appear on the flight manifests. Not one of them.
And this is something you've researched on computer?
I've researched this. This is absolutely rock-solid information. The airlines,
and I've heard this from more people than you, but
yeah,
I'm just wondering.
The airlines published the flight lists, and these guys were not on the manifest. Also, the guys who were several of the guys who were supposedly on these airplanes that flew into the towers and supposedly flew into the airplane. They did fly into the towers, supposedly flew into the Pentagon. They have actually, some of these people have been found by the BBC to be alive, and they've been interviewed, and the interviews have been published in the BBC press. I mean, in the BBC that they have a website,
mm-hmm.
and they published these interviews on the websites, and they showed even some of them on the BBC News.
That was the supposed
people.
These
are the very people that supposedly flew into buildings. Now, I think it's pretty amazing that they can walk away from those buildings after they flew into them and go back to their jobs in the various parts of the Middle East.
Yeah, indeed.
So you have, you know, and of course you've never seen this in the U.S. press. They will not allow this information to come out in the United States.
Well, let's jump back to Super Stooge Day, or Super Tuesday, I should say.
Yeah.
Respectfully, if I had any. But what's your take on what's going on today?
It's a huge charade. The media has sort of manipulated information from the very beginning to end up with these two candidates, both of whom are members of the criminal corporate cabal. They both have advisors who have fomented wars and committed war crimes that are on their staff of advisors.
Who are you pointing toward here?
Well, you have Wesley Clark, for instance, who was the guy who was the NATO commander during the Kosovo bombing, a totally illegal operation, completely against the Geneva Conventions, completely against the United Nations Charter. These were illegal bombings. When the United States started their push to bomb Serbia, there were a few hundred incidents of ethnic cleansing. When that bombing started, that figure went up to tens of thousands. Okay, the United States caused the ethnic cleansing in Serbia. They didn't start preventing it with their bombing. Okay, so that's one example. And Wesley Clark was a pivotal guy in all of that. Then you have Zbigniew Brzezinski, I'm sorry, who was the architect of the Mujahideen thing in Afghanistan and was very proud that he had produced Al-Qaeda, basically. He's the guy who designed Al-Qaeda, and he did it through the ISI in Pakistan. The CIA worked through the ISI to produce the Taliban, who took over in Afghanistan after the Russians left. And he was just like a key character in that. Now, he's one of Obama's advisors. So, you know, why do we think these guys are qualified to be president? And if you look at what these people are saying, if you look at what Clinton and Obama are saying, they're not saying they're going to pull all of our troops out of Iraq. Neither one of them have said that.
In fact, when asked
point blank in one of the debates while Kucinich was still in the race, asked point blank, will you commit to getting all of our troops out of Iraq? They both said no. Both of them.
Well, let's leave it on that note. This is Super Tuesday, and God knows what the outcome will be.
Let me just go one more thing.
All right.
Cynthia McKinney, who was run out of office basically by the corporate cabal in her district in Georgia, is now running for the nomination of the Green Party as president.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't like political parties, so I don't even like the Green Party, because I think we shouldn't have a political party. There's no mention of political parties in the Constitution, by the way.
That's true.
The Democrats and Republicans are never mentioned in the Constitution. She's running for president, and she's the only candidate now still in the race who has a real practical agenda for the United States of America. If she is elected president, we will radically change course, and we will end the 150-year imperialistic thrust that the United States has been on since we fabricated a reason to go to war with Mexico in 1845. So look at Cynthia McKinney and look up Dennis Kucinich. Go to Kucinich.us, because he's now up against the Democratic Party trying to get him out of office in Cleveland. They want to get him out of the U.S. Senate because he's just started talking again about how he wants to impeach Bush as well as Cheney, which he's already done. So they're spending millions and millions of dollars in the Cleveland area trying to defeat him in the primaries with another candidate. So you need to go to Kucinich.us and see what he wants to do about it.
Maybe we can stop them from getting rid of the honest ones. Anyway.
The honest one.
The honest one, yeah, very likely. Back to Jerry Davis of Burning Coal Theater. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else. Today we're talking about Burning Coal Theater, and this is Jerry Davis, the artistic director and founder of that project. Back to you, Jerry. I don't know what we haven't covered yet, but...
I wanted to talk a little bit, if we still have time, about some of our upcoming projects. In April, we're going to produce a, sort of a unique musical, a gospel musical called Crowns, which is, this will sound strange, but even as I say it, it sounds strange to me, but it was based on a coffee table book by the same title. It was written by a young woman from Atlanta named Regina Taylor, and it's about the hats that African-American women wear to church on Sunday.
Interesting.
Oh, neat.
And it's very abstract, a very nonlinear, but essentially the story is about a young girl from the Bronx whose brother is killed in gang-related violence, and her family ships her off to North Carolina, where another part of her family lives, and they think she'll learn a little bit more about life in the rural, more rural area than she's learning with the gang infested streets of New York, and so they ship her off. But anyway, that's basically the whole story. It's just beautiful. It's such a beautiful thing. We have a wonderful director named Rebecca Holderness, who's very abstract, out of the box kind of director, and she's going to be directing the play. It runs April 10th through 27th at the Murphy School Auditorium.
So is this one continuing story, or is it sketches of variations? I'm thinking of the hats as more as sketches, but
yes, I think that's a very good way to describe the structure of the play. And then the music is part of it too, the religious music, which is so, you know, whatever else we can say about organized religion, the music it continues to touch us. The art that comes out of those churches continues to touch us in profound ways, and there's a lot of that in the you know, we're gonna rock the rafters, as they say. We have
how big is the cast?
There are eight actors. It's an all African American cast, you know, the Murphy School needs to be a place. It's situated right on the divide between the historically black and white sections of Raleigh, right there at Person Street. And it needs to be a place where the African-American community in Southeast Raleigh comes to and thinks of as their home as well. If it's not, it's going to be, we're going to have failed.
That's a good way of opening the door.
Right, I think so. And then in the fall, this is an exceptional accomplishment on the part of our company, and I'm very proud of it. The British playwright David Edgar, who is most known to the United States audiences for the adaptation of Nicholas Nickleby that he wrote back in the 80s, that won the Tony Award and was it ran, I think, 8 hours or something like that.
Oh, wow.
But he has written a new play that has been produced in London at the National Theatre, and it's about conflict resolution the Eastern Europe around the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. Which goes back to some of the things John Paul was talking about. David Edgar is going to give us the American premiere of this play, and he's actually going to come and work with us for a couple of weeks in Raleigh.
Wonderful.
He's in his 60s now, and he's at that point in his life where he, you know, has accomplished pretty much everything a person can accomplish in his field, and he now feels like he can do whatever he wants. And what he wants to do is to make this particular play a little more palatable to the English, to the American ear. It's very European and very dense in some ways, and he wants to see if he can find subtle ways to make it a little bit more understandable to the non-European ear, I guess is a better way of putting it.
Well, let me put an offer on the table while you're thinking on that note. Okay. If you ever have a situation like that evolving, where you get a little entourage of artists working together, collaborating, and you have any desire to do that on the radio, please consider the Speakeasy, because I would love to do a little back and forth on that kind of creativity.
What a fascinating idea. And he's one of the great minds really working in our field today. He's written plays for the last 35 or 40 years, and he's politically on the left of center, but his plays are fair. They're fair-minded, and they give voice to both sides of the argument, which is what elevates them beyond propaganda into the realm of art, I think. And that he's willing to come here and spend time, you know, in Raleigh working with a group of semi-professional actors, mostly, and to allow this play of his, which he put so much time and energy into, and which was so successful in England, to have its American premiere at a small company in Raleigh, North Carolina.
That's pretty extraordinary. How did you accomplish that?
Well, we had, in our very first season, 11 years ago, we did a play called Pentecost, which David wrote. It's part of the trilogy of plays that this new play is a part of, too. And by the way, the title, which I haven't given you yet, is The Prisoner's Dilemma. Anyway, 11 years ago, we did Pentecost, and we did, if I may modestly state the case,
we did
a bang-up job of it.
All right, good.
We had sold-out audiences. It was produced in a high school gymnasium in North Raleigh in June with no air conditioning, and it was over 100 degrees.
That's a loyal audience.
Ouch.
And we set up scaffolding and created the theater in the middle of this gymnasium and made a real... I mean, it was an extraordinary event, and we turned people away at the door. It was
wow.
The word of mouth was so profound, and I think we only ever lost two people out of the audience in the entire run of the show, and that was on a Sunday, which means it was a matinee, which means it was even hotter in the thing. And an elderly couple left at intermission and said that they were leaving because the chairs weren't comfortable enough for them.
No.
They didn't even notice the heat. So we knew we had something with that, and indeed the word got back to David in England through a Chapel Hill-based actress, Kate Finlayson, was in the cast, and Kate's sister, Alex, is a playwright who knows David because she's had several plays done in England. And so anyway, the word got back to David of this extraordinary production, and he wrote to us and said,
incredible.
You know, if you ever decide to do it again, I'd like to come see it. And in our 10th anniversary season, which was last year, just finished up this spring, we did. We revived it again, and we wrote to him and said, you know, remember that offer you made to us?
Yes.
And he said, sure, I'll come. And he flew in for a
incredible.
Week. He went around to college, some of the college campuses. There was such a strange moment where I realized I referred earlier to the director, Ann Bogart, who's one of the great, maybe the most... world-renowned American theater director working today. She was in Raleigh the same week that David Edgar was here, and also here over at Peace College was an actor, playwright, theater director. He's done everything in his life. A guy named Eddie Levi Lee, who's originally from Georgia, lives in Seattle now, but he's an old country boy, you know, big old, you know, heavy-set country boy with flowing white hair. And so here we had Ann Bogart, this great internationally renowned director. We had David Edgar, this brilliant British playwright and Tony Award-winning writer. And we had Eddie Levi Lee all in the same town. And
Did they connect?
I went to the City of Raleigh Arts Commission, and I said to June Guralnick, the executive director there, I said, we can't let this pass. We have to do something. And Meredith College was good enough to give us the space. And so on a Thursday afternoon, I believe it was, we gathered them in a room together, and we just let them talk for a couple of hours. And what an
fantastic.
Extraordinary...
You recorded it, I would
assume. Yes, we did. Oh, you bet we did.
I would love to hear that.
It's available. We have a little CD.
Wonderful.
Or a DVD, I guess. I'm technologically...
Let me know how to acquire it.
Okay. Very good. Very good. So anyway, so the fact that David is willing to do this for us is something that's very meaningful to me.
And again, I give you that same invitation for an entourage here at the Speakeasy.
He would love to do that.
Because you'd have it recorded as well. It'll be on CD and then also on the World Wide Web.
That's right. We'll make that happen if we can.
Keep that in mind.
Okay. Okay, good. So
for any creative endeavor, for that matter.
Okay, very good. So lots of stuff coming up, you know, in the future. We're doing. I've been trying for 10 years to get the rights to a farce, very political in nature, called Hysteria by the British writer Terry Johnson. It's a play about Sigmund Freud's last minutes. He died of cancer of the jaw, and the play presupposes that he's on opium at the end of his life to deal with the pain of this cancer, and he keeps going back. So the play is, again, non-linear. It moves back and forth in time and jumps around, and Salvador Dali appears in it. But it's a farce, you know, with the man in the closet with his pants down and the pretty maid in the closet with him or whatever. And the third character is this young woman who is the daughter of one of Freud's case studies, mm-hmm. and she's come back to exact revenge upon him for what he did to her mother years before. And so it's a very deep and emotional play, and one of the most one of the funniest plays that I've read in years. I've been trying for 10 years to get the rights to it, and I finally managed to do it. And we're going to have North Carolina premiere of it in November.
Great. Fantastic.
It's called Hysteria.
Please remind me of that. I mean, I'm hoping we'll stay in touch by email at this point.
I don't ever. I'm like a bulldog, Claudia. Good. Once I get a hold of you, I don't let go. You'll find
I'll hold
that
you
out
to
soon.
That. Good.
Okay. And then
am I going to have to put you in my spam box?
Yes. Yes. At least you might have to shut the computer down. And then we're going to do a Spanish language play in February of next year. I think February by a Spanish writer named Juan Mayorga. He wrote this beautiful play. Called Way to Heaven, which is actually a Holocaust play. It's a play about the fictitious town that the Nazis built and peopled with Jewish prisoners to sort of a showcase that they could bring, like, the Red Cross and other institutions there and say, look, we're not mistreating these people. Look at what a wonderful town they have. And it's been adapted into English by an Irishman. And we're going to do it with a bilingual cast, and we're going to run it in Spanish and in English on alternating performances for 3 weeks next spring.
Neat.
And then we're going to close with Twelfth Night, Shakespeare's Twelfth Night in the spring, which we will then, after the main stage run, tour to high schools as we do every year. So we're doing a lot of stuff.
Old Willie the Shake again.
Yes, Billy Shakes comes out yet again.
Well, folks out there, just want to let you know, this is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, and John Paul and I are still inviting underwriters to join us. If you have any interest in that regard, please go to my website, which is www.claudioarts.com. That's claudioarts.com, and we will give you all the information. I think it's a real deal here. The money goes directly to the station for their use, not for mine. So we certainly welcome your support. I want to thank Jerry Davis of Burning Coal Theater.
Thank you for having me here, guys. It's been terrific.
It's been great having you on, and of course my co-host,
wonderful.
John Paul.
Thank you very much.
And this is yours truly, and I think we're at the point of signing off. Touchstones is coming up, so folks, tune in for that.
Well, let's just mention that here at WCOM, everyone that works here is a volunteer. None of us get paid. And we have a station wish list, which I'm looking at right now, mentions that there are things here at the station that we need. And what we need is for people who have money to give us money. And then we also have a list of things that we need, like outdoor speakers, toner and paper, two-line phone, dollars to buy the phone lines.
The two-line phone with extension.
Right. Vinyl road signs, bumper stickers, cling film stickers, heavy-duty CD players. There are lots of other things that we need. And what we need is for people to call here or go online to communityradio.coop.
And you can call 919-619-1023.
Correct.
Or you can email Audrey at volunteer@communityradio.coop.
Right. And just do that and help us out at the community radio station. This is a one-of-a-kind station.
Absolutely. We still have freedom of speech going on here, folks.
Nobody else in this whole area is doing this particular kind of thing.
And with that, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And this is your host, Claudio, of The Speakeasy, signing off. Cheers. And on one more note from The Speakeasy, my bad on this, folks. I forgot to ask Jerry Davis to give us the website and all that information of Burning Coal Theater. Please do so.
It's burningcoal.org, and you can find out how to get tickets for Inherit the Wind, which runs through February 17th.
Burningcoal.org.
That's right.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Once again, a chill night wind blows its gales across the sea as the sunset casts an inflamed and rippled hue across the waters. Vast distances of liquid motion stretch their infinity before me, and I have rarely felt so free. The sails are drawn for a night of rest. Where I go from here, the sea knows best. As the veils of night descend upon me, the moon emits its silvery canvas against a spectacle of aquatic celebration, as is only seen by night. The stars are scattered worlds of light against an opaque sky. And the nightfall is a constant whisper of the mysteries around me. Truly, all description would defy the beauty I choose herein to proclaim. Yet still, though encompassed by more wonder than many a man has e'er freed his soul to admire, my thoughts are adrift with the song of my heart, and the song of my heart with the voice of my soul. Adrift, 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 drifting ever back.